The Dalai Lama, once in one of his most famous statements maybe, said, "My religion is kindness." It's very beautiful. It's very accessible. You don't have to be Buddhist to appreciate that. And of course that's one of the reasons why he's become such a kind of great ambassador for peace and reconciliation and contemplation and meditation. But I think it's very interesting that he put that statement in those terms, "My religion is kindness." We might expect such an eminent Buddhist figure to speak more about wisdom, compassion, emptiness. Something a bit more Buddhist sounding, no? "My religion is emptiness." Sounds proper Buddhist. But he didn't say that, and he's pretty proper Buddhist, the Dalai Lama. "My religion is kindness." Useful for us to reflect upon. We can easily get caught up in the practice of wisdom, awareness, penetration, insight, depth, emptiness. Just very useful to ask ourselves, what about kindness? In the last few weeks, we've arranged that I live in a place in the south of France where we've had people come for Dharma practice for the last 10 years or so, and more and more people have come, which is great, and the place has become too small, and so we've managed to find another place, and in the next few months we're going to move from this small place to the bigger place, all being well. And the new place is a Zen monastery, so the monks and nuns are living there practicing. But for them the opposite has happened. The place is too big for them. Their numbers are smaller. They built a monastery in Poland, I think. And they'll stay in France, but they'll go to Poland for their big retreats instead of having them at this place. So it's very nice for us. It's a beautiful place. And has a beautiful Japanese-style Dharma hall and lots of bamboo and nice kind of Zen-like atmosphere. It's very nice. But when we heard about this place, this particular branch of Zen in France has got a kind of bad reputation. See, Buddhists, despite all this right speech stuff, Buddhists too can be gossips. So this particular branch of Zen, they're known generally as being very proper, very good with the form. Hence the beautiful meditation hall. They wear these very fantastic Zen robes and lots of bamboo and that kind of thing. But they're known, this is the reputation, for giving a lot of emphasis to the beautiful Zen form and not much emphasis to the wisdom, to meditation, to depth of practice. So this is the reputation. So with this view and opinion in mind, I went to meet them to look at the place and the place was very beautiful and to organize the move. And what most struck me was how kind these people were. Just four of them left living there full time. They've been there 12 years in this place, living very closely together. And it's true that while I was there I didn't see them in the meditation hall very often. But I was really very touched, and I've been there four times now to check things out and to discuss the details with them. And each time I've been really very, very touched by how kind and generous they've been. And I think that's a real measure of spiritual practice. Coming out with the kind of esoteric words and sounding very deep doesn't really cut the mustard, doesn't really do the trick. course it can be very helpful, but certainly for me, what I respond to is a quality of real caring and kindness. And I think if we're interested in a practice or a spiritual tradition or in being with a certain teacher, that's a very useful yardstick to look for the quality of care and kindness that's there, because that can't be manufactured, that can't be made up. In Dharma teachings, what I'm calling kindness, I guess really we could talk about two different aspects of it. Metta and Karuna, those are the Pali words. So, and the Buddha called these two, Metta and Karuna, part of four heavenly realms, divine abidings, limitless states of being. Beautiful places to hang out, I could call that. Not just beautiful, but limitlessly so. Limitless means without limit. We can't find the end of the bounty and possibility for care and kindness in life. Boundless states of mind. It's something very inspiring. So, metta, probably you're mostly familiar with these terms, but I'll just speak a little bit about each one. Metta is more the movement of the heart, and karuna is more when that comes into action. So metta and karuna, usually at least in English, translated as loving kindness, which I don't really like too much, I have to say. I find it a little bit sugary somehow, a bit sweety sweet. I think just kindness, or care, or deep friendship, or love. But loving kindness, it's a bit too much for me. How do you translate metta in Hebrew? Huh? And what does that mean?
It has a lot of foundations
from the heart.
Oh, yeah.
Usually it means from the heart, but it also means deep friendship.
Good.
Very much.
Yeah, much better than loving kindness. Yeah, good. What, say it again? Okay, I won't bother. So, the metta refers more to that inner movement of the response of the heart. The response of the heart in care, in friendship, in connection, in love, in empathy. It's that which brings us very close. It's that which responds to suffering. And karuna, then, is the kind of active response to that. Feel the sense of being close to something, the movement of the heart, and the response is there. And I'll speak a little bit more about that later on. But initially, just to look at metta, this quality of heart that really cares, that response. I've noticed for myself, just being here the last few days, these helicopter gunships that fly so often across the sky. It's quite a shock for me. Maybe you're very used to it. I don't know. I'm not sure I could ever get too used to it, because it's a shocking symbol somehow. When I was a boy, I was a big fan of helicopters. I was always really fascinated by helicopters, and this kind of what do you want to be when you grow up thing. Well, what I wanted to be was a helicopter pilot. And then at one point, I discovered that the way you got to be a helicopter pilot was joining the army. And then I changed direction of what I wanted to be. I was never a Dharma teacher, that's for sure. So, very regularly, no? I don't know how many times, but at least once every hour, these helicopter gunships come across the sky. Huh?
It's
symbolic place here also. Atomic.
I think it's worse than what? What, energy plant or missile plant?
Nuclear bomb.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's good to know. Okay, all right, okay, whatever. Let's stick with the gunships. That's enough for now. Okay. Okay. So, the
they have a base here.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I passed it, not this time, but last time I came here 3 years ago, we drove past. I saw it was a big base. So because of the big base, no doubt, the helicopter gunships are flying back and forth. When I see them coming, there's an impact on the heart, because everything, all the imagery that I can respond with is an imagery of suffering. And that spreads out in so many different directions. I think of of course you know all this better than me, but these are the eyes I see it with. And I think of all of you at 18 joining the army, and I think of the intensity of that experience that I can imagine that must be, and that I know from talking to so many friends that have been in the army. And here comes one now. And the position that people are put in, flying those gunships, and what they're for, and the fear that people are living under, Israelis and Palestinians, the anger and the aggression and the intensity of suffering that all that is about. And what can I do? Walking quietly in the desert and confronted in the midst of the very beautiful environment that we have here to practice, the support that we offer each other, the safety of being here in the desert practicing Dharma together. The opportunity, we're well fed 3 times a day, we have a quiet place to sleep, we have a place to sleep. It's really extraordinary good fortune that we have to be here at all. And in the midst of the appreciation of all that good fortune, it's a very strong image, these helicopter gunships coming back and forth. And in a moment, what can I do? I'm here to practice with you and to look at life in the way that we're doing. But of course, the heart responds in that acknowledgement of the suffering that those helicopter gunships represent, and just in caring about that. Just in caring. This is metta. Not that I'm about to spring into action to solve the problems of Israel. What can I do? But it would be a terrible shame if, because I can't do anything, one of two things happened. Either I just shut down. That's nothing to do with me. What can I do? Or somehow the sense of that pain is too much and I just turn away from it. Desensitize myself to it. That would be one way. Or the other way, that I feel overwhelmed by it. Oh, it's a terrible situation. Oh, these poor people. Oh, it's all too much. And I find myself just kind of in despair at the situation. Both things are not helpful. To desensitize myself, to shut out the reality of that, and the contrast of my situation being here, our situation being here, and the situation in the sky above us, helicopter gunships. But if we're careful not to shut down and desensitize, and at the same time not to let ourselves just be overwhelmed by the emotional wave that can bring up, then there's room for the response of the heart, for real caring. And real caring doesn't stop anywhere. It includes everybody involved. It doesn't include one half of the equation and not the others. Everybody I can think of connected with the whole military complex that's going on, that I see in the helicopter gunships, there's no question in it for me of right or wrong. I just see, wherever I look, connected with that, fear, insecurity, aggression, suffering. And in that moment, the heart doesn't need to take a position or right any wrongs, but the heart is asked to acknowledge that and to let it into the heart, to meet it. And this world in general, more than anything, really needs care and kindness. And if Dharma practice is about responding to what's there, responding to what presents itself, then I think it's a very authentic and beautiful and powerful statement when the Dalai Lama says, "My religion is kindness." I don't know how much difference it would make in the world if everybody sat cross-legged and gazed at their breathing for half an hour every morning. We could ruminate on the possible good vibes of everybody meditating in the mornings, I don't know. But just think if everybody was to orientate their life towards kindness. I'm not so idealistic to expect that suddenly everybody is going to do that, but just by seeing the immediate power of human kindness to act as a force in the world. So, kindness, care, response of the heart, love, is really, really worthy of our attention. Really, really important. And when I talk about kindness in the world, or care in the world, then for these days at least, this is our world. And so, in the context of just what we're doing here, I'd like to look at what kindness means in the context of our practice. Metta meditation, as I'm sure you all experienced, is sometimes taught as a complementary practice or an accompanying practice to shamatha vipassana, calm and insight. And some people have found it useful to take long periods of time just to practice metta, and in that sense of cultivating sensitivity, cultivating care, cultivating kindness. But as well as metta, as the idea of, as a separate or complementary practice, awareness practice itself, in order to be authentic, has to carry that sense of care with it. There's an American teacher called Stephen Levine. When he teaches meditation, he always talks about merciful awareness. He doesn't just talk about awareness, he says merciful awareness. Merciful, you understand? Okay, so caring awareness, I usually say. Caring awareness.
People?
Achamim.
Achamim.
Rachamim.
Yes. Compassion is different.
Okay. So, let's stick with caring. This is it. Caring awareness. So that the quality of attention itself carries that caring for. Otherwise, it can't be intimate with what's happening. Otherwise, it's a rather dry observation. And in the guided meditations this afternoon, I tried to speak to that a little bit. I said, talk about taking care of what's happening. And just to look and see as we practice, as we look at our experience, are we taking a rather detached or dry view of what's happening? Or is there the willingness to actually soften around it? To not just observe it, but to actually be involved with, to get our hands dirty, if you like, in the process. We have to be dynamically, actively, passionately involved with what's happening. Buddha taught a lot about non-attachment, and sometimes that gets misunderstood and presented as detachment. And that's not at all the same thing. If we find ourselves aloof from our experience, that's not non-attachment, that's cut off, that's disassociated. So, in order for our investigation, our insight, our awareness to really bear fruit, it needs to be coloured with, accompanied by, soaked in, a real, real caring for what's happening. Metta is also a wonderful antidote in practice to harshness. Harshness, you understand? Harshness means being hard, being tight, being rough, being unkind. And tragically, there can be an awful lot of harshness in meditation practice. Generally, people that come on meditation retreats seem to be a really nice bunch of people. So far, at the end of a retreat, when the silence breaks and we can talk to each other, I've never heard anyone go up to somebody else and say, "You're rubbish at meditating." People seem to say lots of nice things, but they never say, "Oh, you didn't look like you were very mindful at all. Why don't you just give up? I don't know why you bothered coming here." I'm glad to say I've never heard it. People are generally really nice to each other. But people come and see me in an interview or speak in the group, and it seems that's just what they've been saying to themselves. "You're rubbish at meditating. Why did you bother? You can't even get concentrated for a few minutes." Terrible. We wouldn't dream of saying it to someone else, but the person we're most close to, we treat terribly. Metta is invaluable. Essential antidote to that kind of harshness. You're sitting there, scattered mind, aching legs, dull, useless. We open our eyes, and we just see Buddhas all around everyone. Straight backed. And we can just tell that they're all really mindful. Except me. The useless one. And finally, we don't know what else to do, so we just close our eyes again. But then, the person next to us opens their eyes, looks around. "Oh! Everyone else is Buddha. Look at this one next to me, so straight. Eyes closed. But me, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear." One after the other. And I know this because I'm sitting at the front, so I can see you one after the other. If you notice that tendency, and it shows itself in 100 different ways, but basically that incredible nagging, driving, complaining, judging, harsh voice of critical voice. Metta is the antidote. Metta, but where can the metta go? It's very hard to feel metta to oneself. Oh yes, I'm all right, may I be happy, may I be happy. I'm a useless meditator, but may I be happy. Very hard. But to see that part of ourselves, that voice, that harsh voice, that critical voice, how tight it is, how embittered it is, how scared it is, that voice itself needs our care, our concern. How do you feel if a friend, or it doesn't even need to be someone you know, how do you feel if somebody is sitting by themselves very upset saying, I'm useless, I can't manage, I'm not succeeding at all, other people are managing and I can't do it about anything at all. How does the heart respond? Effortlessly. We don't have to think, oh, somebody needs my help here, let's see if I can produce a bit of metta for them. No, the heart responds because we know what it's like to feel that contracted, that tight. We know how painful that is. And yet we give that authority when it's within us, we give that voice when it's within us so much authority. That measuring, terrible measuring we do of how well we're doing. And of course the judgment, if it goes inwardly, it also goes outwardly. These habits of mind have no respect for direction. If we're judging ourselves, automatically we're judging others. If we're judging others, automatically we're judging ourselves. Because there's a constant comparison. I'm like this, and therefore, in relationship to others. He or she is like this, in relation to me. And when we find that, when this comparison is happening, there's three conclusions. Maybe four conclusions. There's four conclusions. One, better than, I'm better than. Two, worse than. Three, about the same as. Or four, I just don't know. It could be better, could be worse, could be the same, I have no idea. Indian spiritual traditions are very good at these kind of things. And if you look in the Buddhist texts or any of the Hindu texts, even that predate the Buddhist texts, they're very good at covering all bases. You know what I mean by that? Covering all options. So then they'll tell you exactly how many options there are and what they all are. And it's nice and neat, there's none left. So these are the four options for judgment. Comparing mind. I compare myself to you, or I compare you to me, and I find better, worse, same, or just so confused I don't know. Each one of those is stressful. Each one of them. If I find I'm better than, well, I've really got this old meditation stuff. Oh yes, I understand. I think I could be at the front next year. We feel at some moment, suddenly the clouds in the mind clear for 10 minutes, and that's it. We're two stops from enlightenment. And then we feel some moments, and okay, nice to feel some encouragement in practice, but we have to take care. Because that, if we're getting our momentum from that, comparing ourselves with others, finding that we're actually pretty good, It's hard to sustain that. And we start to nourish ourselves from that feeling of puffed up, from that feeling of success. What happens to success? It's conditioned. Success only exists because of its opposite, failure. If there was no failure, we couldn't recognize success. We can only recognize success in relation to failure. So when we see ourselves as I'm succeeding, I'm doing really well, it feels nice in that moment, but it's judgment. It's just as pernicious as, oh God, I'm useless. Because we feel the pressure to carry on feeling like that. We're trying to keep that momentum, that good feeling going. Whoever managed to stay feeling sharp, witty, clever, attractive, and all the rest of it for 10 minutes? The pressure, and it doesn't matter which sphere of life it's in. If it's about success in meditation practice, if it's about success in relationships, if it's about success with humor or social skills. You know, we find ourselves, often social life is quite kind of awkward. And then for 10 minutes we get this kind of flow going where we say two jokes in a row and people laugh and we think, oh, maybe I've got it. Maybe I am just Mr. Snappy. But can you imagine the pressure to try and keep that going? And some people, you see sometimes people who are very witty, very at ease, very kind of, you know, kind of socially good. But you can see it becomes a kind of, it becomes its own trap that you can't get off. What a huge amount of energy it takes to sustain that that hamster wheel. Keep running, trying to maintain the sense of feeling okay about ourselves. I'm really okay, really. Yes, I'm witty, I'm clever, I'm hanging in there, I'm doing okay. Conditioned underneath by the terror of losing that. And similarly, then, we compare ourselves and find ourselves worse than. And the pain, the down on ourselves, the seeming uphill struggle to try and get back to some more, less miserable human condition. Same as, kind of rather insecure, get lost among the crowd, no one of distinction, dull. Average, mediocre. And sometimes we just don't know, and that feels really uncomfortable. We just kind of don't know where we are. And so there's the whole area of judging ourselves, and it doesn't as I say, it doesn't matter whether it's judging ourselves or judging others, because they absolutely go together. They can't exist separately. As soon as we judge in one direction, it's always in relation to. So it has to move in the other direction as well. Kindness is the remedy to judgment. Kindness to that harsh voice itself. So if you notice that there's that kind of heavy critical voice going on in your practice, in your life, same thing. If it's in your life, where do you see it? We see it when we pay attention. We see it in practice. And if you see it in your practice, it's certainly going on in your life. So if we see that harshness, that critic, can we have the perspective to see it as that? To see judgmental voice as judgmental voice. Give him a character, if you like. Him or her. A colour. A wardrobe. A silly hat. Anything you like. Imagine him sitting there.
You're useless at meditation.
So that we something to take the extraordinarily strong belief in it away. And I think humour is really helpful in this. So let it, sometimes we just, the nagging's going on, let it really open up to it, let it say anything it likes, and it can say some such strange things that eventually we start to see how it's preposterous. You understand preposterous? Ridiculous, over the top, daft. That's why, if you can imagine it, as this comic character, this kind of rather sort of mean, sort of long-nosed, I didn't say that. This spiteful, lonely character. And even if somebody's being horrible, in this case it's our own sense of ourselves, this inner critic that's being horrible, even if someone's being horrible, if we see that it's coming from a place of loneliness and insecurity and fear, the heart responds to that. We can't help but feel sorry for someone who's lonely and scared. And so really, really to look for that, if you notice that harshness, and it may be to greater or lesser extent, it may be something that at the moment, maybe something you've seen very clearly and isn't an issue. It's certainly one of those things. Some things in practice, we need to see them, it seems, again and again and again and again. And some things, if we really see them absolutely clearly, we pull the rug out from under them. They just lose their power. And if we can see the emptiness of the inner critic, if we can see the frailty of the situation, if we can see the ridiculousness of it, if we can see that it's just built up of out of insecurity, fear, mean-spiritedness, and how much energy it takes and how painful it is to have that, those kind of arrows being shot at ourselves from within all the time. If we really see into that and take care of it, it loses its power just like that. People, many times on retreats, and I've kind of explored this with people, and they're in the heat and the knot of this kind of self-criticism, and they find a way to really see it and to feel, ow, what pain that voice is in, how tight it is within here. And in seeing the pain it's in, naturally the heart responds. There's care, there's space, there's willingness to just cradle it. Like when a baby cries. When a baby cries, we see there's distress, there's agitation. What do we do? We don't say, oh, shut up, baby. Naturally the heart responds. We take the child and we try to make it feel safe, secure, we give it space, and we're patient. We rock it. And that possibility is there in the same way with this poor inner critic that's in the same condition as an agitated baby. He doesn't know what it wants. He's just, it's agitated, it's hot, it's confused, it's scared. And somehow what the heart can do is to respond to that in the same way as with the baby, to cradle it, to let it be, to not try and shut it up, because that's more of the same, isn't it? Oh, no, I'm judging myself. That's another judging thought. He told me to stop doing that. More of the same. So to see if we can find our way in, to let it have its life, to not try and stop it, but to stop adding fuel to the fire. That fuel of that relentless self-criticism. And the power of the inner critic is gone. Can't sustain itself in the face of us really stopping pushing against it and really caring. And when its power's gone, that's really freeing. It's replaced with confidence. I'm not talking about the kind of arrogant, pumped up, big view of oneself, but what the Buddha called sadha. Sadha means confidence. Sometimes translated as faith as well. But it's not so much faith in something, as a confidence in the power of care, in the power of attention. Confidence that that which is painful and petty and tight and knotty can be transformed, can be let go of. And that care and attention are such skillful tools for doing that. When the Buddha talks about metta and karuna as being boundless qualities of mind, they're boundless in as much as they're the natural fruits of understanding. It's hard, we need to make a kind of effort to care sometimes, when that care needs to cross the gap or the boundary between myself and someone else, or between aspects of myself, even in an inner way. And yet we sometimes get the intuition in Dhamma practice that these rigid boundaries that we habitually create and act through aren't as rigid as they might seem. We may have had the sense, walking together in a line in the desert, sitting together quietly. It may not be so much related to other people here, but the connection with the nature as we just sit and feel the wind. It may be any number of situations, spectacular or very simple, present or past, where we just feel close to life. So close to life that we actually can't find a dividing line, a boundary. And as I was talking last night about deep experience being the vehicle for understanding, these moments of real intimacy with life, beautiful and sweet as they are, the real significance of them is what they intuit, what they invite. That understanding that we're not as separate as mind would have us believe. And as the seeming veil of that separation gets thinner through understanding, so the heart travels more easily, more naturally, more freely across what seemed to be a dividing space before. If I walk along and bang my foot easily, naturally, my hand reaches down to take care of it. I don't need to do a bit of Buddhist practice in between to start generating the good feeling. Naturally. In such a way, in just the same way, if the boundaries between what we've got so used to calling self and other are that much thinner, if I look around and don't see a whole bunch of separate blocks, this and that and him and her, and here and there, and this and that, and good and bad. If I look around and see the texture of life, the indivisible texture of life, then where there's hurt, the heart just responds. Naturally, it has to. And so the extent to which in our own lives, in our own practice, we free ourselves from the contractions of self-preoccupation, from the contractions of what I need and what I want and what I have to do and my own story and how tight that can get, to the extent through understanding we free ourselves from that, to that extent our capacity to respond with the heart is there. My teacher once Love is the child of enlightenment. And we see, hopefully, in the lives of people we might admire or respect, in the lives of kind of the great saints, we see that incredible force of love, of care, of response that's naturally there. And that is the only real hallmark, I would say, of authentic understanding. Authentic understanding finds its expression in caring. And what that caring might look like, we don't know. It could look like many different things. It could look like social activism, it could look like building hospitals, it could look like teaching others, it could look like sitting in a cave beaming good vibes to the world. All of which would be equally authentic expressions of that understanding. But it's something quite beautiful to see that taking the world in the microcosm of this body and mind, the Buddha said in this fathom long body, something about this body is the whole world, basically. In this very body, the whole world can be found. Because all things share the same nature, here and there. That which we really see, insight into anicca. The whole world, coming and going, dropping away, falling about our ears. Endless impermanence everywhere we look. But it's useless to us just as a good idea. But we don't need to go around looking for impermanence. Everything we pay attention to has a beginning and an end. So if we look at the world in the microcosm of this extraordinary event, life, consciousness, all of this, incredible, how does this happen? Incredible. If we really attend to that, the fruits of that understanding show themselves as the heart's capacity to love. And so, this being here, these privileged conditions of being here in the desert, of the safety, the support, the kindness, the web of love that we're held in, the web of support that we're practicing in, it is itself a direct response to the suffering of the world. A vital response to that suffering, among many other authentic responses. But it's very helpful to reflect on that and to remember that we're not doing this in isolation, that nothing happens in isolation, that this web of kindness and support we feel here is part of the web that all life coexists in, and that we're so close to that. So close that close isn't even a good enough word. We're absolutely involved in that. We're completely non-separate from that. And the more we see that non-separation, the more the heart responds. The more kindness unfolds in the world. And the more that vital force of kindness, that so powerful force of human kindness, can inform the strange experiment called life that we're all living. So to that end, and in that spirit, May we, each of us,